For ourselves, the time between sails and funnels was a long time, and the cultural difference between crews of sail and steam, never mind the coming air crews, is profound. But for the Pacific tribes in their pre-industrial setting, it was no time at all. The various crews of different vehicles of different ages were to a Melanesian a set of different images, not products in the Western sense. Each image for them is not necessarily a function or a logical consequence of a preceding image, as is the case with a structured product that has a technological development in industrial time. Images to a Melanesian are associative, not sequential. Therefore, we have to consider that a truly alien psychology may have no sense of simple sequential Western constant improvement time, just as a Melanesian does not reason that a sail crew came before or after a steam crew. This is not completely unfamiliar to us. The 1960s culture looked back to a pre-industrial age, and science itself looks forward to a time when a great everything is explained. These are modern myths, quite identical to Genesis in form, content, and psychology. Neither is the Melanesian idea of time and change as mere scene shifts in a universal theater unfamiliar. Wartime airplane crews on temporary stations scoffed at being asked by Melanesians if they personally knew a certain white man who had come out of the sea long ago. According to missionaries, the story of this, probably shipwrecked, man had been told for several hundred years. But like mirrors placed face to face, there are mutual astonishments. When Captain Cook's reports eventually came back to 18th century England, the excitement aroused by Cook's descriptions of idyllic native life in the far Pacific was a spur to burgeoning ideas that would form the Romantic movement. Even Rousseau threw away his watch when he heard of a life without tasks, structures, interpretations, or even discoveries. By the 1960s, many of the long-haired sons and daughters of the scoffing bomber pilots were all looking for the secrets of the Melanesians as the Melanesians looked for the secrets of their fathers. Being alive means to a large extent being confused. Confusion defines both the thinking process itself and the highest intelligence. Those who are not confused to some degree are not thinking. Only the skeptic and grocer are certain, with their finite inputs and outputs, their profit and their loss. But both maintain certainty only by ignoring the advertisements for the goods, and almost unconsciously neglecting to ask questions about where the goods come from. The brain reasons not by old industrial ideas of objective facts but by mistakes and amnesia, by images and suggestion, by the most outrageous self-advertising and by hypocrisy and blindness. Out of such rubbish came both our morality that raises us above the animals and our creative imagination that gets us into such terrible trouble with the gods. When contact occurs, if it has not happened already, even many times in the past, and perhaps is still ongoing, we will inherit their confusions and uncertainties as the poor things will undoubtedly inherit our own. This will make the universe appear not only very strange, but as the great biologist J.B.S. Haldane said long ago, possibly stranger than we could imagine. With Haldane's thought in mind, here are two examples of almost Melanesian absurdity, high strangeness, and cultural confusion combined, but working all together in our own society. Timothy Good says, a German scientist who worked at a top-secret U.S./German space research center whose name I cannot disclose, alleges that the director of the center was himself an alien, and furthermore of specifically Venusian origin. This knowledge was restricted to a quorum of scientists at the center, and my informant stated that the director provided them with information which proved invaluable to their research. Adamski himself had often claimed that Professor Hermann Oberth, the pioneer space scientist whose students included Wernher von Braun, had received direct extraterrestrial assistance. 72 The space travelers, he says, work in industries and government positions throughout the world. They may also be found in the armed forces of every nation, working in divisions of science, communications, medical corps, etc., where they are not required to be trained for slaughter of their fellow men. to express such a positive sentiment in the same breath as he mentions name of Nazi fellow traveler Robert and ex-SS man von Braun, shows perfectly that mixture of childish innocence, optimism, and naivety with which George Adamski attempted to organize his beliefs and his life. Concerning such cultural confusions, the ideas of Charles Fort, that remarkable researcher and philosopher of the unexplained, is useful. Fort saw humanity in general, and scientists in particular, as deep sea fish trying to account for the fall of wreckage from a huge ship that has exploded. The fish have no concept or a 5-year diary, a wooden leg, an umbrella, or a split steel door of a cargo hold, never mind the myriad of other unidentified objects descending into their particular bandwidth of perception. Yet, as Fort would say, if fish think at all they will systemize, they will interpret, just like the astronomers, they will, like scientists, produce accuracies and certainties beyond the sun and moon. These will be based upon scraps of inconceivable cosmic wreckage, some electrical bits of which might even respond with a last bleep or two, producing endless fishy scrolls of prophecy and revelation concerning aquatic destiny. What the reactions of a fragment of live coral, or a passing eel would be to such a voice from on high is anybody's guess. I'm in the state of mind, wrote Fort, of a savage who might find upon a shore, buoyant parts of a piano and a paddle that was carved by cruder hands than his own, something light and summery from India, and a fur overcoat from Russia. The higher idealist is the super dogmatist of a local savage who can hold out, without a flurry of a doubt, that a piano washed up on a beach is the trunk of a palm that a shark has bitten, leaving its teeth in it. Chapter 7, The Ufonauts Are the Liars, Not the Contactees. It is rather strange that George Adamski chose to end Flying Saucers Len landed in December 1952. He does not take the opportunity to include in the 55 pages sent to Werner Laurie describing what he says happened to him on the 18th of February 1953. It seems there was still time to update his manuscript that would be published in September of 1953. However, he waited until the publication in America in 1955 of Inside the Spaceships to announce not a new contact, but one that had occurred before Flying Saucers Have Landed was published some 2 years before. Paradoxically, this adds to the authenticity of Adamski's claims. A greater commercial advantage would have been gained if Inside the Spaceships had been conceived as a straight sequential update of the first book. But the man himself is at one with splintered planes of cross-reference. Instead of telling what happened next, he tells us what happened before his last punchline. There have been suggestions that Lucy McGuinness had a considerable influence on the writing of / Inside the Spaceships. This is somewhat unlikely, considering the backspacing in time. If the conventionally minded Lucy had helped write it as a piece of faction, she would surely have tidied it up and made the events describe the perfectly sequential commercial answer to any inevitable what happened next? Question. Any other self-respecting editor would have screamed at Adamski to do this. A serious investigator must never equate breaks in the consistency of received information with untruth. Contrary to the view of the more behaviorist of artificial intelligence researchers, the mind works by very fuzzy paradigms, and not simple yes, no circuitry. Life would be far more simple than it is if we assumed that a congenital liar and a proven fraud could not have had a perfectly valid UFO sighting. Skeptics, we must remember, reject photographs because they are too clear on the one hand or too obscure on the other. It is therefore often more than useless to play slippery slope evidence games with skeptics. Witnesses who have more than one UFO sighting also come under suspicion, as do those who have books about UFOs on their shelves. Few skeptics offer any ideas about how the things from the books get into the sky, and vice versa. Those who have seen a UFO, and who have had the misfortune to write about such things beforehand are also unreliable witnesses. But those who have a tendency to believe, what a wonderful and magical tendency that is, well, they are the most damned witnesses of all. A really sophisticated investigator must consider that such inconsistencies, and unlikelihoods as encountered in the Adamski story might well be a measure of truth rather than the reverse. If the stories of his encounters were being consciously rationed out for us, they would have been far easier to assimilate than if done in a less fuzzy manner. As the two books stand, however, Adamski's conceptual dyslexia, which we shall meet on other occasions, acts as a long camera pull from the first book to the second, and the overlapping in time part superimposes the two. There is no better example of the way in which his mind works. It sheds light on many inconsistencies encountered in his work. His confusions are an effective mirror of the interplay of mind and character, substance and idea, and the way such things communicate in terms of mimicry, self-deception, and simulacra. A good example of this fuzzy process at work is the FBI report on Adamski dated January 28, 1953.78. The mistakes and inconsistencies it contains could have been plain incompetence combined with a covert plan to catch Adamski out. Certainly there were those who wished to entangle him in contradictions and plain lies, in the manner of Silas Newton, who, as we have seen, was certainly an FBI fellow traveler and informant. In the 1953 report, the agent records that Adamski said that a ladder descended from what appeared to be a small stairway in the bottom of the craft, and a spaceman came down the steps. However, researcher Carl Flock has pointed out that when Flying Saucers Have Landed was published some 9 months later, there is no such stairway described, and the spaceman appears at first with no saucer in sight at all. When we think that this descending ladder would have made a far prettier story, we are left with two intriguing questions. First, if it was a better description, why did Adamski leave it out of his later account? Here, the suspicion centers on the agent himself, because there is included in this same 1953 report an astonishing piece of misinformation. Either the agent concerned was superbly incompetent or he was making it all up as he went along, which is exactly what poor Adamski was accused of doing. The agent has Adamski saying that his wife Mary was with him during the desert encounter. For Adamski to say this would have been to lay up so much dynamite for himself, it is well nigh impossible to believe that he did say it. Certainly the six witnesses who signed affidavits would have denied such a presence immediately, and Adamski knew that in making statements to the FBI he was legally liable. As has been said, Mary hated her husband's saucer interests, and was therefore the last person on earth to go on a saucer hunt. Again, if Adamski did say his wife was present, then he took the unbelievable risk of the agent asking to see Mary then and there, and having to face the direct consequences of denying her presence, if indeed at that time Mary was resident at Pelhama at all. There is a blanked out section in the report before the phrase, "and his wife Mary," and all would be explained if Mary was the name of the wife of one of the two other men witnesses. However, their wives were both named Betty. Timothy Good, in conversation with me, believes such inconstancies were mistakes made by the agent. But if so, they were rather blatant and quite consciously specific mistakes. The agent might have misunderstood Adamski's heavy polish pronunciation of Betty for Mary, but that is some assumption to make. In the light of this, how much credibility then are we to put on the report of the presence of the descending ladder mentioned by the agent and not mentioned by Adamski in the later published text? That these mistakes were also made in the presence of an accompanying USAF officer from the OSEET, who presumably made his own report, is even more difficult to believe. It would be interesting to unearth this separate report to see if this officer, in turn, made the same mistakes. If this example illustrates the quality of material reaching Edgar Hoover, then much doubt is cast on the reliability of FBI reports. In the succeeding years, this situation was to affect American culture in many areas other than those dominated by the UFO. Another example of how something Adamski was so naive as to risk total disaster within hours is afforded by a letter to the Fortean Times from the Honorable Mark Dowding, the grandson of Lord Dowding. Mark Dowding claims that his father, Derek Dowding, told him that while giving Adamski a lift in his car, Adamski said, by way of passing comment, that he had fabricated the whole flying saucer story. The car journey must have been in 1959, and it must have been made to or from the station on the one night Adamski lectured in Tunbridge Wells at a meeting presided over by Lord Dowding himself. Tuhay made such a devastating comment in passing to man he had only just met, and to have risked not being blown out of the water by such a remark, is almost impossible to believe, if only because at this time, Adamski was in the middle of his European tour. That Derek Dowding was an ardent skeptic, in reaction to his father, we suppose, and was also a Royal Air Force attaché to the Pentagon in the 1950s, is very interesting. Yes, the skeptics might indeed be correct when they say that such folk as contactees make mistakes, and suffer from all kinds of personal selectivity and psychosocial amnesia. But Adamski's personal witness burns its way through this fuzzy mess, as other testimony burns through the Roswell haze and the mysteries of events in Rendlesham Forest in Britain. 83 Something truly fantastic and significant happened in the Californian desert in November 20, 1952, as at Roswell 4 on July 4, 1947, and in Rendlesham Forest in December 1980. There is, of course, a third alternative, which most baffled and skeptical researchers avoid. If a locus of lying witnesses and psychosocial fabrications can sculpt a partiality complete with disappearing actors, partial events, and disappearing evidence, then we have a phenomenon which pales in comparison to the mysterious UFO. But perhaps in our entertainment state, we should no longer try and solve mysteries, so much as tried to enter their peculiar dimensions. The same postmodern thought that what we perceive as real may, on close inspection, consist of countless incomplete scripts is only just beginning to enter ufological discussions. In this respect, Inside the Spaceships offers us a mystery to enter rather than solve. It is to enter a drama scripted by Kafka and Borges, filmed by Goldwyn Mayer, and performed by the Marx Brothers. That Adamski was not at all Jewish is therefore quite remarkable. We now enter one of the great fairy stories of the 20th century. Time, sometime during the early evening of the 18th of February 1953. A hunch tells Adamski to leave the quiet starlight and peace of his mountain home. He obviously does not think the world knows yet of the troubles on the mountain. He decides to travel into Los Angeles, a city of lights and noise, of rush and restlessness. He tells us that he has not come to the city for excitement, as if he did not have enough of that on the mountain, but has been drawn there by the kind of urgent impression described in Flying Saucers Have Landed. 6 He checks into a small familiar hotel, and from then on, the scene is pure noir. After the bellboy had brought my suitcase to the room, received his tip and departed, writes Adamski, I stood uncertainly in the middle of the floor. It was only about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and since I literally did not know what had brought me here, I felt rather at a loose end. I went over to the window and stood staring out at the busy street. There certainly was no inspiration there. Coming to a sudden decision, he goes downstairs to the cocktail bar. A waiter who knew him well, and who was fascinated by flying saucers, greets him. The waiter says that a number of people who knew Adamski from his radio and TV programs also knew that he stayed in this particular hotel whenever he was in town. In the manner of fans, they had asked the waiter to give them a call if he should appear. An almost reluctant Adamski agrees. A small crowd assembles, and he discusses saucer matters with them. He dines out of the hotel, and when he gets back, he decides to ring a woman friend he knows. The woman, a previous mountain student of his, is glad to come and see him, for she says she has certain personal problems she wishes to discuss with her friend and teacher. He buys a newspaper, goes to his room to avoid being recognized again, but is restless waiting for the girl, as her journey will take an hour or more. Humphrey Bogart should have done it. Adamski meets the girl, reassures her, and accompanies her to the corner where she takes a streetcar. His restless feeling persists. He looks at his wristwatch. It is 10:30. What happens next is straight out of a prototype version of their Matrix, and laugh as we may, it is a scene which has haunted the Western media imagination ever since. The Men in Black. Though he didn't create this archetype all by himself, rumors about such had been circulating since 1949. Adamski did have a hand in it, which is achievement enough, and let any scoffers try and do nearly as much. He probably got bits of this modern legend from his friendship with Frank Scully, and from knowledge of Alfred K. Bender's experience with his International Flying Saucer Bureau that was formed in 1952. Allegedly, three men in black smashed this organization to pieces in 1953, through harassment. But note that the following Adamski incident was certainly written before Gray Barker's 1956 book They Knew Too Much About Flying Saucers that was inspired by Alfred K. Bender's story. Two men approach Adamski. They look like average young businessmen. One is over 6 feet in height, has a ruddy complexion, black hair, and the kind of sparkle that suggests great enjoyment of life. The other younger man is shorter, has grayish blue eyes, sandy hair, and smiles as he addresses Adamski by name. This man extends his hand in a certain manner, and Adamski is overjoyed to realize that this is the very signal given by the Venusian he met in the desert on the 20th of November 1952. The younger man invites him to accompany them, but only if he has the time to do so. The men, now silent, leave the lobby with Adamski walking between them, and turn into a parking lot. No less than a four-door black Pontiac sedan pulls up, at which point Adamski shows that he must be the most optimistic man who has ever been born. They had not spoken during this short time, yet inwardly I knew that these men were true friends. I felt no urge to ask where they proposed to take me, nor did it seem odd that they had volunteered no information. Never has being taken for a ride by four silent strangers who say they are from outer space been so inspiring. I sensed a power which made me feel like a child in the company of beings of vast wisdom and compassion. Eventually the taller man speaks, "You have been very patient," the speaker smiled and indicated the driver. "He is from the planet you call Mars. I am from the one you call Saturn." The bizarre group travel for at least an hour and a half along smooth highways. It is dark, but Adamski senses that they are entering desert country. The car turns off the main road and travels along a rough track for nearly a quarter of an hour before their Martian says, "We have a surprise for you." A spaceship comes down and soon standing there beside it, giving greetings to Adamski is Orthon, the man from Venus he met on his original desert encounter. Orthon is now speaking English more fully, with only a slight trace of an accent. Since there is no such thing as English without an accent, we are left wondering what he sounded like, and how, in the 3 months between encounters, he learned almost perfect English. There begins a series of incidents reminiscent of Jules Verne. Orthon says he has been doing some running repairs, and promptly empties out onto the sand what appears to be a small amount of molten metal from a small crucible. This is cool enough, however, for Adamski to wrap some in a handkerchief, much to the amusement of the Space Brothers. He claimed to have this sample to the end of his days. Purely for the sake of convenience, Adamski now says he will name the rest of the spacemen. The Martian he calls Firkin, the Saturnian is named Ranmu. He now enters the ship. Chapter 8. The Doll's House Machine. At first we are surprised and a little disappointed. Here are things we recognize and know. The interior is almost as mechanical-industrial as Jules Verne's submarine, Nautilus. There are hangars and power supplies, lifts, ramps, and battery chargers. There is even the charming touch of a small blacksmith's forge of all things. Wonderful news for the nut and bolt theorists, although as an indication of the shaky stage flat of a conspiracy, it is just as wonderful. There is no organ to play, as in Verne's submarine, but then this is not so much a spaceship, more a doll's house full of early consumer expectancies. Adamski describes the chintzes and the glassware lovingly. It is as if he felt that they were the final compensation for the many years of his dropout past, when he scraped a living preaching mainly in those trailer and clapboard communities that were the prototype communes of the 1950s. At times his description of the interior of the spaceship makes it appear like the reject footage of South Pacific. We suspect not so much his sanity, more his consumer maturity. Led by Ranmu and Furkan and Orthon, our gullible hero enters a shopping center full of window busts come alive in a kind of gay version of a Flash Gordon film. In this camp ship, ever-smiling male drones in ski suits stand at antique Buck Rogers control panels full of buttons and flashing lights. The whole scene is a B-feature combination of the lurid post-war covers of magazines such as Astounding, Unknown, and Marvel. But before we dismiss Adamski, we again have to bear in mind that a Melanesian native taken aboard a cruise liner would likely suffer a similar distortion of critical focus. When Yali, a native who had seen service in the Australian Army during the World War II, saw ritual masks in a Queensland, been saying to you is in conflict with many things your people have been taught to believe as truth. This, in itself, is of no importance, since that which was learned yesterday serves only as a stepping stone towards the greater truth we can learn tomorrow. That is the law of progress. Once on the right path, it cannot be otherwise. It is essential always that men work and strive together with open minds. If this is spiritual enlightenment, then perhaps we should go down on our knees and praise the impure. On such occasions, Adamski as hero and likable rascal both, disappoints us. In / Inside the Spaceships, he actually puts the phrase natural law into the mouth of the Big Chief, not mentioning that natural law was taught by himself for 30 years all over California. It is disappointing that Adamski took himself so seriously. He would have earned much more credibility if he had asked the paste-up old queen whether he did weddings and bar mitzvahs. The Big Chief is so awful he could be almost real. If Adamski wanted this kind of thing, he needn't have bothered with flying saucers at all. Downtown Los Angeles in the 1950s would certainly have catered to his needs. But certainly his readers loved this vapid setting, just as the man himself was impressed with the saucer's Turkish brothel decor, the trailer trash furniture, and the airport lounge food and drink. The Star Trek chat about magnetic drives should have alerted Adamski just as the Melanesian Yali became alert to the duplicitous and confusing messages from missionaries. After supper, the two robed geisha girls do a kind of Muppet dance, and then change to go on duty as pilots of the ship, if you please. The only thing missing in this saucer is the pianist from Casablanca. There is an early Maul quality about these early contactee experiences. Adamski's religious writings express a leveled off spiritual profundity, instant as the new technology of frozen burgers in the new Bel Air icebox, personally delivered by a man straight out of Death of a Salesman. Contactees of this period almost invariably talk about space gods as if they were neighbors just dropped in for mid-morning coffee. Fred Steckling, Adamski's number one preaching convert, claims he met space folk all over the world, and his words echo the voice of his teacher. Our space brothers know so well how difficult it really is for 102s, the adults, to teach the little ones the value of life. Our friends from other worlds never poison a child's mind as we so often do. By imposing our dislikes, opinions, and assumptions upon others, we violate the very basic law of Christianity. This is cool more sanity taken to its limits. Emotionally, most early contactees were such wide-eyed mall creatures. They appear to have undergone transformations in which their higher feelings have become pure muzak. Profundity is instant, sterilized and packaged, or, being far too disruptive, is banned in the weatherproof mall of their new consumer beliefs. Dread is banished from both its well-managed interior and the advertisements which hold the entire stage set together. At times the whole Adamski personality becomes as gnomic as an evangelical text for a junior Sunday school. As a man, we cannot help feeling on occasion that a man such as he might have been programmed as the perfect prototype customer for the burgeoning consumer society. This society was beginning to flex its junior muscles in the early 1950s with a narrow-tuned bandwidth of response identical to that of the first television soap operas. With this in mind, we can now perhaps get a much better idea than Adamski what Orthon's mission was all about. Contact may indeed be contact with a highly developed information field that has the power to change metaphor. An advanced intelligence may have evolved far beyond industrial hard fact into pure advertisement stuff.